have them interrogated, then transferred to stasis cells, William said. If they happen to know anything useful, we can follow up on it at Cadiz.
The next hour went slowly, as the investigation team carefully searched the pirate ship, finding very little apart from hundreds of pornographic data chips and plenty of evidence that the ship had been involved in dozens of attacks. Most of the main computer had been destroyed. That part of the self-destruct system had worked perfectly, and what remained was scrambled beyond immediate use. William watched as the damaged cores were removed from their compartment, knowing that the techs on Cadiz would have their work cut out for them. It was highly unlikely they'd be able to produce anything more than gibberish or standard operating files.
None of the crew kept a journal,
Hobbs told William as he returned to the airlock. The Marine brandished a little black book.
Or, at least, none we could use. This book details sexual conquests rather than anything else.
William wasn't surprised. The military banned its personnel from keeping personal logs, knowing that enemy intelligence agents would try to access them in hopes of finding actionable intelligence. It was clear the pirates probably felt the same way, too. If one of their crew had kept a journal, it might wind up being used against them. A note of a pirate's base location alone would be disastrous.
Add it to the evidence locker,
he said. He had no wish to read a sexual journal belonging to a pirate.
Can this ship be taken under tow? The chief engineer believes it can be towed by one of the freighters,
Hobbs said.
But its hull is badly damaged. There won't be much prize money.
There will be a baseline rate, if nothing else,
William pointed out. Taking a pirate ship out of commission alone was worthwhile. If any actionable intelligence was pulled out of the hulk, even on Cadiz, the crew would be in line for another bonus.
Besides, we can always melt the hull down for scrap.
He smiled as the Marines pulled their prisoners to their feet, none too gently, and pushed them towards the airlock. Some of the pirates looked panicky as they were shoved through the hatch, as if they expected to discover the airlock opened into empty space, while others just looked resigned. They'd had enough time, he decided, to come to terms with the fact that their reign of terror was over.
Doctor,
he said, as Dr. Katie Bram entered the compartment.
What do you have to report?
Dr. Bram, she had always insisted on being called Katie, looked grim. She'd been in the Navy almost as long as William himself, and she'd seen more than her fair share of horror, but she had always seemed optimistic. Not this time, William suspected. Pirate ships were always houses of true horror. All but one of the women will require extensive rejuvenation treatments as well as counseling, she said bluntly. She never bothered to sugarcoat bad news. The good news is that the sheer scale of their wounds implies they were definitely captives. The bad news is that they will probably have to be permanently supervised by female personnel until we reach Cadiz. Their conduct will leave much to be desired.
They attempted to come on to the Marines,
Hobbs put in.
Thank you, young man,
Dr. Bram snapped. She glared at Hobbs, then switched her attention back to William. They've had servitude beaten into them, Commander. It's the only way they know to guarantee their safety. I don't think they will ever return to what they were before they were captured. William winced.
Do we know who they were?
We're running their DNA through the records now, the doctor said. But I would be surprised if we found a match. Their genetic patterns don't suggest any high-tech world. They could have come from Hebrides, William thought. The pirates hadn't wanted much from his homeworld, apart from food, drink, and women. And the planetary government had no choice but to send them whatever they wanted. Some of the girls had volunteered. Others had been drafted. Can we take them home? Dr. Bram cleared her throat loudly. The two male captives have been beaten quite badly, she continued. They were worked over by professionals. The damage was not extensive or permanent, but it would have been very painful. I think we can safely assume they're not willing pirates.
Keep an eye on them anyway,
William ordered. Stockholm Syndrome could strike any kind of captive, no matter how badly they were treated. And if the pirates had forced their captives to get their hands dirty? He shook his head.
And see if they memorized anything they can tell us.
I'll have my staff supervise the transfer to Lightning, the doctor said, as though she expected objections. I think we will probably need to put most of the former prisoners in stasis. There's too many of them for my staff to handle.
See to it, William said.
He sighed. Yet another problem.
But they will need to answer questions eventually.
He took one final walk through the vessel, noting the sheer lack of maintenance that had contributed to her quick defeat, then returned to the shuttles as the crew prepared to leave the pirate ship for the last time. The female prisoners, according to Davidson, had experienced real problems with boarding the shuttles until two of the female Marines had removed their own armor. Even so, the prisoners had shied away from them. The doctors had eventually resorted to sedating all of the pirates' former captives, with the intention of leaving them out of it until the ship reached Cadiz. The interrogations will begin in 30 minutes, Davidson informed him. Interrogating the former pirates was a Marine chore. Do you wish to witness? The honest answer was no, but William knew he should be there.
I'll catch a cup of coffee and a shower, then join you, he said instead.
He was ruefully aware he stunk after spending several hours on the pirate ship.
Hold the interrogation until I arrive.
He walked back to his cabin, showered, took a long drink of coffee, and then returned to Marine Country. The prisoners had been separated, ensuring they couldn't come up with a shared story to tell the Marines, although William would have been surprised if they'd managed to cooperate in any case. Pirates weren't used to cooperating with one another, no matter the prize. He forced himself to look impassive as he walked into the interrogation chamber and peered through the one-way glass. The pirate definitely didn't look impressive, he decided, as the Marines cuffed him to the chair and then attached a pair of monitors to his forehead. He was a young man, barely out of his teens. William suspected, despite himself, that he knew the boy's story. Like so many others, he would have viewed a career in space as more glamorous than a life behind the rear end of a mule on the ground. And he would have rapidly found himself so desperate for work that he would have taken the first job that came along. It was sheer bad luck it had been on a pirate ship.
Young and impressionable, William thought. And desperate.
It was never a good combination.
The corpsman did a quick medical check, Davidson said as he entered the compartment. There are no medical issues nor any interfering implants. It's unlikely he knows anything of substance.
We'll see, William said.
It was impossible to say in advance what would serve as a clue to lead the Navy to the pirate base. The pirate might have seen something that would fit in with another piece of information from a second pirate. He broke off as Hobbs began the interrogation.
These devices, Hobbs said, allow us to monitor your brain waves as you respond to our questions. Should you try to lie to us, we will know about it. If you try to lie to us repeatedly, we will put you in a lab and access your memories directly. This process tends to result in the victim becoming brain dead. Do you understand me?
The prisoner nodded rapidly.
Good, Hobbs said.
He stepped backwards and smiled.
Where were you born?
Roslyn, the pirate said. William watched with growing impatience as Hobbs slowly built up a baseline on the pirate's brainwaves. It was the closest humanity had come to a perfect lie detector, he knew. But it wasn't entirely perfect, even without the problem of separating between subjective truth and objective truth. And it could be fooled by a set of implants, if the pirate had been deemed important enough to have them. Instead, it was starting to look as though he knew nothing beyond his duties. The pirates certainly didn't bother to tell him where they were going or where they were based. The odd piece of data, however, concerned two men who had joined the pirate crew as senior officers, then died with the other officers. Surprisingly, they hadn't joined the pirates in their games, even when they'd had new victims for their pleasures. Instead, they just alternated between the bridge and their cabin while the captain fawned on them. The pirates had suspected the newcomers were actually paying their wages, such as they were. But their commander had always discouraged questioning.
"They didn't mind if we destroyed our targets," the pirate explained frantically.
He seemed almost desperate to help the interrogator now. It was the only way he could hope to keep his life.
"We got paid anyway."
William and Davidson exchanged glances. Pirate economics were haphazard at the best of times, but there were some understandable principles. A destroyed ship, her cargo smashed to atoms, was worthless. The pirates wouldn't be able to take her cargo to one of the poorer worlds, a place where no one would ask questions and sell their takings. They wouldn't even be able to have fun with the crew. And they would have to replenish the weapons they'd fired. The bastards would lose money on the raid.
"That's odd," Davidson said.
He seemed to want to say something, but held his tongue.
"We need to bring this to the captain's attention."
"Yes,"
William agreed. He'd noticed that Captain Falcone and Davidson spent a great deal of time together. It wasn't uncommon. The captain could hardly confide in anyone else. But she seemed to take it to excess.
"And we will, once we've interrogated the remaining prisoners."
He sighed as he looked back at the prisoner, who was currently outlining some of the raids he'd seen. It was the same story, he knew. Once seduced, the pirate had nowhere else to go. But William was damned if he would feel sorry for the idiot. He could have walked away, even gone back to his homeworld. Instead, he'd made the choice to stay with the pirates and join in their atrocities wholeheartedly.
"I hope the bastard chokes on nightmare,"
William said bitterly.
"Or that he gets killed on the surface."
"He might well discover he's a very small fish among sharks," Davidson agreed.
His tone was expressionless.
"The very worst of the Commonwealth can be found there."
William nodded. It wasn't death, he knew. Or at least it wasn't immediate death, meted out by his own hands. But it was close enough.
Chapter 10.
"They were happy to destroy the ships?"
"Yes, Captain," Davidson said. "They still got paid."
Kat frowned. She had been sitting in her office, writing the first report on the encounter for the Admiralty, when the XO and Davidson had requested an audience. But their report was unbelievable. What sort of pirate actually took losses on his raids? But one of the lessons she'd had to endure from her tutors bubbled up in her mind. The government can subsidize a service from taxpayers' money, even though the service is operated at a loss, he'd said. Sometimes this serves a practical purpose. The service is necessary. She looked at her XO.
"Someone is subsidizing the pirate operations," she said. "The two strangers on the ships might well have been working for the theocracy."
It made sense, she told herself. There was no logic to pirates destroying ships. But if they were actually being paid anyway, no matter the outcome, they'd be happy to smash as many freighters as they could find into atoms. The report would have to be rewritten.
"If that's the case,"
the XO said slowly,
"why didn't they just launch a missile at us as soon as they had a lock on our location?"
"Greed," Davidson speculated. "They'd have had a chance to sell our hull and cargo as well as collect their paycheck from their backers."
"Or have their fun with the crew," Kat added tartly. The medical report had made for horrifying reading. "But this is a worrying development."
"Yes, Captain," Davidson said. "It's also problematic because we have no proof the theocracy is behind it. There are other multi-system powers in the galaxy."
"None as threatening as the theocracy," Kat countered. But she knew he was right.
"What did the autopsy show?"
"Nothing we can use to identify them," Davidson admitted.
"The dead men could have come from anywhere. There are no specific genetic traits linked to the theocracy. The men did have basic enhancements, but they couldn't be narrowed down to a single world."
"They could have gotten them from anywhere," Kat said. It would have been more surprising to encounter baseline humans in space. Even newly contacted worlds made the effort to get medical enhancements for its population. So, we have no real proof.
And no way to hunt down the pirate base, the Exo said. It could be anywhere.
He sighed.
None of the surviving pirates know anything important, he added. Their hands are caked in blood, their souls stained by their crimes, yet they know nothing we can use to track their bases down and destroy them. All we can do is drop them off on Cadiz for transfer to Nightmare.
Put them in stasis, Cat ordered. It was 2 weeks to Cadiz, and she was damned if she was feeding the prisoners. They could be dropped off at the planet where they would be held until the next leg of their journey. Is there any point in continuing to sweep the pirate ship?
I don't believe so,
the Exo said.
The ship's computers are smashed, her data net is shattered, and her navigational systems completely wiped. Cadiz might be able to pull something from the wreckage, but we don't have a specialized forensic team.
Then have her taken in tow by one of the freighters, Cat said. Offer to double their pay if they do it without complaining. The Exo smiled.
Aye, aye, Captain.
We should get a bonus out of this, if nothing else, Cat added. She didn't need the prize money, but her crew would be delighted. Please inform the crew that we will get underway in, she checked her wrist comm, 30 minutes. Hopefully, nothing will happen until we reach Cadiz. It was a dismissal, and William recognized it as such. He stood, saluted, and marched out of the hatch. Cat watched him go and then looked at Davidson. Her former lover was smiling slightly. I think he's grown a little more accepting of you, he said bluntly. You did well today, you know. I had a good crew, Cat said automatically. She smiled at him. Thank you. Davidson stood.
I'll get the prisoners into stasis, he said.
He sighed.
One of them did show up on the records.
Cat lifted an eyebrow. There was enough storage capacity in a single computer core to list every man, woman, and child in the entire galaxy, but records were far from complete, even in the Commonwealth. She'd expected the pirate crew to come from the edge of settled space, where there were no records and plenty of worlds happy to take stolen goods, no questions asked. It was unlikely that any files from those worlds would be added to her ship's database.
Ronan Yetika, Davidson said. Child of a nagging mother and largely absentee father, ran away from home 4 years ago, never found until today. God alone knows how he ended up on a pirate ship.
Let him write a letter home, if he wishes, Cat said. She understood the impulse to run away from home. But hers had been much more constructive. Surely this runaway could have applied to Piker's Peak, or one of the more basic training academies. There were plenty of openings for merchant spacers. But we can't make an exception for him.
No, Davidson agreed. We can't.
He paused.
Have you told the Exo about your father's concerns?
Cat shook her head. It would have only heightened his sense that Cat had pulled strings to be assigned to Lightning as her commanding officer.
Probably a good idea, Davidson said.
But I think he's a keen observer.
You will need him at Cadiz, if what your father suspects is true.
I know, Cat said, reluctantly. Davidson gave her a smile that reminded her of their time together.
You may be the captain, he said. But you're not alone. You certainly don't have to do everything yourself.
The buck stops with me, Cat countered. The commandant of Piker's Peak had that burned into every desk in the building. It had taken years for the cadets to understand its true meaning. I can't let him risk his own career for me.
I think he's loyal, Davidson said. And you probably upset his universe by handling the pirates so well.
He saluted, then turned and strode out of the cabin. Cat looked back at her terminal, then started to rewrite her report. Once it was completed, she wrote out a second message for her father. It was possible her report would be lost somewhere within the bureaucratic channels, but a more direct message wouldn't go missing. At least it would serve as evidence that something was badly wrong along the border. She sighed, then stood. She wanted to be on the bridge when the convoy resumed course, and then start carrying out additional drills. The next pirate ship they encountered might just launch a missile at them rather than try to take her ship intact. Or they might open fire on the prow of the convoy instead. "We need more escorts," she thought sourly. More light units would need to be detached from the battle squadrons for escort duties, weakening the fleets patrolling the border. And that might be precisely what they want us to do. "I'm afraid they all had to go into stasis," Dr. Bram said of the pirates' former prisoners when William entered sickbay. "I just don't have the facilities to even begin healing them all." William nodded, unsurprised.
"You did manage to remove the cuffs first? Or take statements?"
"Yes to the first, no to the second," the doctor snapped. She eyed him unpleasantly. "I think you don't understand just how badly they were treated. They really need to spend several weeks in a regeneration chamber, not answer questions from you or any other men."
"I understand,"
William said quickly. Annoying the ship's doctor was never a good idea.
"Do we know who they are?"
"I didn't find a match when I ran their DNA against the records," Katie said. She pointed to a chair on the far side of the compartment, motioning for him to sit down. "But two of them were probably from pastoral worlds. There aren't many within 6 months of here." William sat reluctantly.
"You're sure?"
"They were baseline humans, and I mean baseline," Katie assured him. She dragged a chair over and sat down facing him. "Someone like you has genetic enhancements and improvements, even if they're not spliced into your bloodline. They, on the other hand, have no enhancements at all. My best guess is that their homeworld was a dumping ground for a religious sect the UN decided didn't deserve to stay on Earth." She folded her hands on her lap. Only someone who knew her well would have picked up that sign of tension. "The poor girls were on the verge of death," she added. "I've never seen a group quite so riddled with disease. I'm surprised they even managed to survive the shock of being rescued."
"Some didn't," William said.
Other bodies had been found when the Marines searched the pirate ship.
"What sort of idiot doesn't go for the boosted immune systems at the very least?"
Katie frowned. "Genetic engineering hasn't always been as precise as starship engineering," she said, after a long moment. "The early engineers often pushed ahead in hopes of developing a provable science before they were shut down by their governments. Some of their experiments produced horrors. Others actually laid genetic time bombs in their test subjects that wouldn't explode until their grandchildren were born." She shrugged. "Back then, there were strong reasons to oppose widespread genetic engineering," she added. "There were quite a few sects dedicated to maintaining the purity of humanity's bloodline. One of them could have founded the women's homeworld." William shook his head. Hebrides had never asked to be a low-tech world, but the breakdown had ensured the settlers were thrown back on their own resources long before they were ready. They'd managed to hold on to some technology, yet it hadn't been enough to protect them against pirates and raiders. Or, for that matter, to avoid having most of the population working in the fields just to feed the colony. Why would anyone want to trap themselves on such a world? But humans were strange creatures. Perhaps some of them were strange enough to want to spend the rest of their lives on a farm.
"Thank you, Doctor," he said.
The former slaves wouldn't be needed to testify against their captors, at least.
"Please let me know when they are ready for transfer to Cadiz."
"I'd be happier if they were sent to another world," Katie said. "Cadiz is hardly the most peaceable of locations."
"That's where we're going," William said.
Katie nodded. "You're overdue for your physical, by the way," she added. "I need you back in here within a week."
"I think you just enjoy poking and prodding at me," William teased. "I'm sure regulations give me at least another 2 months before it becomes mandatory."
"Only if you count from the day we left space dock for the final time," Katie informed him, reaching for a glove. She snapped it meaningfully.
If I have to go hunting for you, Commander, it will be a very uncomfortable medical inspection.
William snorted.
I'll come back in 2 days, he said.
By then, any problems with the crew after the battle should be apparent. He didn't expect any, but the thought of prize money had been known to make crewmen do stupid things.
You'll have the table ready?
Of course, Katie said. She paused. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about? William hesitated. Just as the captain could talk to the senior marine, the XO could talk to the ship's doctor. They shared responsibility for the health and well-being of the crew and were expected to meet at least once a week, if only to compare notes. But he wasn't sure he wanted to talk about his personal doubts with her.
No, thank you,
he said finally. He stood.
I'll see you in 2 days.
He strode out of sickbay and started to walk to the bridge, then changed his mind and walked to the observation blister instead. The hatch opened at his approach, revealing the eerie lights of hyperspace. At least it wasn't occupied, he noted as he stepped inside, the hatch hissing closed behind him. Crewmen and women had been known to use the observation blister for a little bit of privacy from time to time. It seemed as if there was nothing between him and the hyperspace storms alarmingly close to the starship's hull. Colors no human had been able to name flickered and flared in the darkness, clouds of glowing mist that looked almost real, if one stared at them for too long. He stepped up to the transparent blister and sighed, remembering just why he preferred living in space to a planetary surface. It was a dangerous life, as the battle they'd fought proved. But it was boundless. One day, perhaps, he would buy a ship of his own and head out beyond the rim of explored space. Who knew what might be lurking out there? He sat down on the bench, mentally reviewing the battle. The captain had done well. Hell, she'd done very well. A pirate ship was rarely a formidable opponent for a full-sized warship, but it could easily have turned nasty. He'd known commanders who would have blown their target away at maximum range or risked allowing the pirate ship closer. Captain Falcone had done neither. She'd handled the battle just right. And what does that say, he asked himself, about her competence? The thought was galling, but it had to be faced. He'd assumed the captain had been promoted through her father pulling strings rather than merit. No, he knew there had been a great deal of string pulling involved. She simply didn't have the experience to be assigned to command a heavy cruiser, at least not without succeeding her commander after his death. And her conduct since assuming command proved her limited experience. Even being an XO on a battle cruiser wasn't enough to simply jump straight into a command chair. She'd made mistakes. They had all been minor, but she'd made them. And he'd worried about what she'd do when faced with a real challenge. But she'd come through it admirably. She'd crippled the pirate ship, captured a number of pirates, and collected physical evidence that suggested someone was bankrolling the operation, rather than taking a commission on their loot. There were other, more experienced commanders who might not have handled it so well. And that meant that he'd underestimated her. It wasn't something he could talk to anyone about, not even to the ship's doctor. Naval officers had no right to privacy. The ship's doctor had a duty to break her oath of confidentiality if she believed one of the crewmen was a serious danger to himself or his fellows. And he wasn't sure what Dr. Bram would do if he confessed his doubts to her. Grumbling about the captain, no matter how she'd been given the job, would be a severe breach of military etiquette. Not that in the end it had mattered. He'd been wrong about her. She was inexperienced, she needed to learn fast, but she wasn't grossly incompetent. Nor had she hidden behind her rank or her father's title. She had acted as befitted a good commanding officer, and he had to admit that, even though it was only in the privacy of his own head. And he should take it into account. The contingency plans he'd been devising to take command if necessary, an act that could be construed as mutiny if the Admiralty happened to want a scapegoat, shouldn't be taken any further. He owed her the same trust and confidence he owed every other commanding officer, at least until the man had proved himself beyond redemption. She wouldn't be the first officer to need to learn fast upon assuming command, he thought. He'd started his career as a crewman, after all, watching the senior chiefs gently manipulate young officers into becoming paragons of virtue. The army did it all the time. It was only the Marines who insisted on having everyone spend a few years as an infantryman first before assigning them to other roles. And I need to stop being so suspicious of her. He turned his head as the hatch opened behind him, revealing a young woman wearing a midshipwoman's uniform. Midshipwoman Cecilia Parkinson, he reminded himself. She was young enough to be his granddaughter, with short, red hair and a freckled face. He couldn't help noting that she looked rather pale and worn, unsurprisingly. But was it the stress of going into combat or something worse?
"I'm sorry, sir," she said, flushing.
She stumbled backwards so rapidly he thought she was about to trip over her own uniform.
"I thought the compartment was free."
"I forgot to lock it," William said.
Had he ever been that young? The captain was barely 10 years older than Cecilia, with far more poise and self-control.
"It isn't a court-martial offense to walk through an unlocked hatch."
The poor girl's face grew even redder, and she muttered something incoherent.
"Don't worry," William said, rising to his feet. "I was just leaving."
She opened her mouth to object, but he stepped past her and through the hatch before she could say a word. It was probably her first real chance to take a break and look out at hyperspace, and he wasn't about to deprive her of it. No true officer would act in such a fashion, and besides, if he remembered what he'd seen in the files correctly, she probably needed some time to think. Making a mental note to have a word with the senior chief, he strode down the corridor and back to the bridge. Chapter 11
"Captain,"
the XO said,
"we are 10 minutes away from Cadiz."
Cat nodded, then sat. The 2 weeks since the pirate attack had passed almost without incident, apart from a brief sensor contact that might have been another pirate vessel, or just another random glitch thrown up by hyperspace. All they could say for certain was that the contact hadn't attempted to close the range and attack.
"The convoy master will be pleased," she said.
He hadn't been too happy when he'd discovered his starship had been tapped to tow the pirate hulk. "Take us back into real space as soon as we reach optimal coordinates." She studied the display as Lightning and her convoy plunged towards Cadiz. Unusually, there were several semi-permanent energy storms near the planet, limiting the number of hyperroutes starships could use to reach the planet. There were guard ships within hyperspace, monitoring constantly for incoming fleets, although she knew there would be far too many false alarms. She'd half expected the approaches to be mined when she'd read the files, but 7th Fleet's CO had apparently decided there was too great a risk of accidentally destroying a civilian ship. If there hadn't been a war looming, Cat would have thought he was right.
"We are entering optimal coordinates now," Wyberg reported, breaking into her thoughts. "Vortex generator online, ready to return to real space."
"Take us out," Cat ordered. It would be a relief to see stars again, even if it marked the start of her mission.
"Now."
Space twisted in front of them, then parted, as though an angry god had torn a hole in the very fabric of reality. Cat gazed at stars shining their light into hyperspace before the first freighter slid through the tear and back into real space. Her ship brought up the rear, closing the tear behind them. An odd feeling ran through the ship, a sensation no one had ever been able to fully describe. Then it faded away. They were back where they belonged.
"We have entered the Cadiz system," Wyberg said, formally.
Cat looked at her XO. "Please make a note in the log," she said. They'd moved from one command region to another. And then transmit our IFF code to Cadiz.
Aye, Captain,
the XO said. Lieutenant Ross echoed him a moment later. Cat looked at the display as the passive sensors started to suck in and process data from all over the Cadiz system. It didn't take an expert eye to realize that the system looked odd, as if it hadn't quite followed normal development patterns. There were installations orbiting the gas giants, and mining stations in the asteroids, but there were relatively few stations near Cadiz itself. The brief guide to the system she'd read during the flight had stated that several corporations had actually invested in terraforming packages for Cadiz 5, a Mars-type world on the very edge of the habitable zone. It was a recipe for later trouble. She sighed. Normally, a Commonwealth world would have a unified government able to handle off-planet development, and a solid claim on their star system. Cadiz, on the other hand, had no unified government. The only power that patrolled the outer edges of their star system was the Royal Navy. Corporate investment in the system had been made without the permission of any local government, thus ensuring that Cadiz's inhabitants received no true benefits from their resources. It was just another problem fueling the growing insurgency on the planet's surface. But we didn't have a choice, she told herself. And her thoughts mocked her. The strong have always told themselves they have no choice but to steal from the rich. She rubbed her eyes. Cadiz sat directly between the Commonwealth and the Theocracy, a world that either side could use as a jumping-off point for an attack into the other's space. It could not be allowed to remain apart from the Commonwealth, some had argued, because the Theocracy had shown no hesitation in invading worlds incapable of defending themselves. And yet the locals hadn't wanted to join the Commonwealth. They might not have been as successful as Tyre, but they had made a solid investment and intended to work towards the future on their own. But the Commonwealth, reluctantly, hadn't respected their wishes. They called it an annexation, Cat knew, and claimed it was for their own good. But the locals weren't happy. And because it was impossible to form a stable government, Cadiz was losing control over its own resources. Indeed, if Cadiz 5 became a settled world in its own right, it would just sow the seeds for more tension. Cadiz might become nothing more than an economic backwater while Cadiz 5 controlled the system. The display bleeped as it picked up the starships orbiting Cadiz. Cat sucked in her breath as she saw the icons for three super dreadnought squadrons, followed by numerous smaller icons representing cruisers, destroyers, and gunboats. It looked, at first, like an unstoppable force, a gathering of the most powerful warships in the galaxy. And yet, as more and more detail appeared on the display, it became evident that something was wrong. Seventh Fleet should be moving around rather than holding the same position. She cringed inwardly as she thought through the implications. There was almost no control over civilian starships moving in and out of the system. Any of them could be a spy ship reporting to the Theocracy. They'd know precisely where to find their targets. Standard procedure was to have the fleet in constant motion, or at least change position every few days. But Admiral Morrison seemed to believe it wasn't necessary.
Captain, Lieutenant Ross said, we have picked up a formal response to our IFF codes.
Cat glanced at her display. It had been nearly 20 minutes since they'd sent the codes. It shouldn't have taken more than 10 minutes to receive a reply.
Sloppy,
her XO muttered. His face was grim.
They should have detected our arrival and challenged us at once.
True, Cat muttered back. They'd come out of hyperspace 5 light minutes from Cadiz, but the twist in space-time should have been detectable from right across the system instantly. Cadiz should have sent a challenge the moment they'd arrived, the signal crossing the IFF code's lightning had sent back. They definitely should have challenged us. She cleared her throat. Did they send us specific orders?
No, Captain, Ross said. They just acknowledged our arrival.
Cat wondered, for a brief moment, if the system had already fallen. The thought sent a chill down her spine. Were they flying right into an ambush? But it seemed unlikely. The super dreadnoughts orbiting Cadiz were Royal Navy designs, while there was no sign that a battle had been fought in the system. No matter the readiness level of Seventh Fleet, she found it impossible to believe the system had fallen without a battle. Someone would have tried to fight. "Keep us on course," she ordered, "and request orbital slots for the convoy."
"Aye, Captain," Ross said.
More disturbing signs started to appear as lightning flew towards the planet. The fleet in orbit should have had at least some of its starships at battle readiness at all times. Instead, their drives and sensors were stepped down to the point it would take nearly an hour to bring them back up to full power. Every ship was also supposed to keep its shield generators on standby. But she had a feeling they hadn't even bothered to take that basic precaution. She shook her head in growing disbelief. Super dreadnoughts were tough, built to take a staggering amount of punishment. But an antimatter warhead impacting against an unprotected hull would be disastrous. She realized Seventh Fleet was staggeringly vulnerable.
"They should be running gunboat patrols, too," the Exo said, through their implants.
It was rude to use implants to talk in front of other people, but it helped keep their conversation private.
"Someone could be sneaking up on the ships under cloak right now, and they wouldn't even have a clue they were there."
Kat couldn't disagree. Cloaking systems were only perfect if the starship under cloak stayed very still, pretending to be a hole in space. A starship under power emitted faint radiations that weren't completely concealed by the cloak, though the vessel would still be hard to track. Gunboat patrols should have made it impossible for someone to sneak up on the fleet. Yet the only gunboats she could see on the display were performing routine maneuvers. They certainly weren't patrolling space as aggressively as she would have liked. She turned her attention to Cadiz itself. There was a smaller orbital presence than she would have expected from a world at its development level, but there were dozens of freighters in orbit, along with several commercial stations. And, she realized slowly, Seventh Fleet didn't seem to be doing anything to inspect the freighters coming in and out of Cadiz. They could be moving heavy weapons down to the surface, yet no one was even searching the ships before they entered orbit. And, by Commonwealth law, any freighter that was allowed to enter orbit was immune from further searches without clear proof of wrongdoing. "There's no single authority here," she thought grimly. "And because of that, it's hard to monitor everything that happens within the star system." The only remotely encouraging sign was the level of security round the orbital starcom, although she would have preferred considerably more. A handful of automated weapons platforms guarded the structure, while a bubble of clear space was enforced by gunboats and marine shuttles. But then losing the starcom would be disastrous, even if the system didn't come under immediate attack. How could the corporate representatives on Cadiz communicate with their superiors without it? She smiled humorlessly.
"Perhaps I should arrange for something to happen to it," she thought. Losing the Starcom would unite all the corporations against Admiral Morrison.
It was nearly 30 minutes before another signal arrived from Cadiz.
"Captain, we have been assigned orbital slots," Ross reported. "There's also a private message for you."
"Pass it over," Kat ordered. Who would send her a private message? But she knew the answer before the message popped up in her inbox. Admiral Morrison, according to her father, was a contemptible social climber. Making the acquaintance of Duke Falcone's daughter could only benefit him in the long run. "And inform System Command that we will take up our orbital slots as quickly as possible." She frowned as she saw the slots appear on the display. The freighters would be entering low orbit, while Lightning herself would be permitted to remain in high orbit, which would allow them some maneuvering room if the shit hit the fan. It didn't look very safe at all, but there was no point in picking a fight with Admiral Morrison, or the system's controllers, such as they were, so quickly. Instead, she rose to her feet and nodded to the Exo. "Mr. Exo, you have the bridge," she said. "Inform me when we enter orbit."
Aye, Captain,
the XO said. Cat saw her forebodings reflected in his eyes as she walked past him and into her ready room. Inside, she waited until the hatch had hissed closed behind her, then sat down at her desk and accessed the private message. It was keyed to her specific command implants, which was oddly amusing. Admiral Morrison might not have been interested in her if she'd still been a commander and XO of a starship, responsible to her captain. It would have suggested she wasn't interested in pulling strings on her own behalf. The thought made her feel coldly furious at her father. She hadn't even looked at the message, but she was sure Admiral Morrison wanted to make use of her. She had run into other senior officers with the same ambition, yet this was different. This commanding officer, thanks to her father, had evidence that she was interested in pulling strings on her own behalf. Gritting her teeth, she pressed her palm against the terminal, then frowned as the holographic image appeared in front of her. Thankfully, the message had been recorded and sent before they were close enough to Cadiz for a real-time conference. Admiral Morrison was strikingly handsome. With muscles on his muscles, his uniform tailored to show his looks and build off to best advantage. But his appearance was too handsome, too striking, to be real. It suggested deep insecurities that even a minor visit to a cosmetic body shop had been unable to cure. Even the genetic engineering that had shaped Kat's appearance had given her something more natural. "But it's easy to see why he impresses some civilians," she thought, as she keyed the switch to start the playback. "He looks the very model of a modern space admiral." "Captain Falcone," Admiral Lord Buckland Morris said. His voice was perfect, too, almost as practiced as one of the political leaders speaking in the Houses of Parliament. But there was something about it that suggested it was far from natural. "Please allow me to welcome you to Cadiz." Kat nodded impatiently. It wasn't common for starship commanders to be sent messages of welcome by the station commander. They were meant to be good little subordinates and present themselves to the admiral's office as soon as they entered orbit. Sending Kat a message, she knew, was not a good sign. "I look forward to meeting you in person," the admiral continued. "You are welcome to visit my office once your ship has entered orbit. I would also like to invite you to a party at my estate the following week. You would be more than welcome." "A party?" Kat repeated, incredulously. Who the hell did the admiral think she was, Candy Falcone? "He wants me to go to a party?" "Your crew are, of course, welcome to begin their shore leave roster while the convoy prepares itself for its next destination," the admiral concluded.
He smiled at her. It would have been attractive if she hadn't been so sure it was fake.
"And I look forward to meeting you in person."
Insecure, Kat thought as the message came to an end. She couldn't help being reminded of her first boyfriend, although they'd both been teenagers at the time. "He told me the same things twice, as if he were afraid I'd miss what he was saying or go somewhere else. And so did the admiral." Her father would have wanted her to get to know the admiral, she knew, although it was because he wanted evidence he could use to stick a knife in Morrison's back. Kat herself would have preferred to spend as little time with the admiral as possible. But a direct invitation from her superior officer would be hard to avoid, even with her family connections. Someone without them would have had to humor the admiral, at least as long as they valued their career. She winced. Suddenly, the condition of the orbiting super dreadnoughts made a great deal of sense.
"You're jumping to conclusions," she thought, coldly. "You don't know if the super dreadnought commanders have been spending too much time on the planet's surface."
But it did seem alarmingly plausible. "Record," she ordered, after she was sure she could trust her voice to remain even. "Admiral Morrison, I will land on the planet's surface once my ship has entered orbit. I look forward to meeting you in person. However, I have duties to my ship and I may not be able to attend your party. Thank you for your time. It was borderline rude, she knew. She'd known officers and aristocrats who would have exploded under much less provocation, but she had a feeling Admiral Morrison would let it slide. She sent the message with a tap of the console, then called the XO into her ready room. When he arrived, she replayed the message for him, smiling to herself at his reaction. "I will not be attending his party," she said, making the word a curse. "But I can't avoid visiting him in person." The XO didn't disagree.
"It's protocol," he said.
He hesitated noticeably.
"You should take a marine detachment with you."
Kat made a face. The official press releases claimed that violence on the surface was declining, but the instructions for traveling from the spaceport to Gibraltar, the planet's capital city, suggested otherwise. She would be traveling in an armored convoy, guarded by several platoons of soldiers. It didn't suggest the planet was even remotely safe. "That would probably violate some unwritten rule," she said. She took a long breath. "Do we have a list of frontrunners for shore leave?"
"Yes, Captain,"
the XO said. He pulled his datapad off his belt, then held it out to her.
"I've put myself on the list, of course."
They shared a smile. It was an old joke. An XO who couldn't manipulate the system to his own advantage was in the wrong job. "Once I return to the ship, I'd like you to go with the first party," Kat said. "I need your impressions of the planet's surface, too." She paused. "Besides, you need some leave," she added. "I know you haven't had any for the last 9 months."
"I've had worse," the XO said.
He hesitated.
"Captain, I don't believe we should risk allowing more than 50 crewmen down to the surface at any one time. If the system comes under attack..."
He allowed his voice to trail off, but it didn't matter. Kat had already thought of it for herself. "See to it," she ordered. There was one major spaceport on the planet and a handful of minor ones. Getting her crew back to the ship if the system came under attack would be a nightmare. "And make sure we have enough manpower on hand to fight if necessary." The XO saluted, then withdrew, leaving Kat alone with her thoughts. Chapter 12.
"They're diverting us to a different approach route," Midshipman Thomas Morse said.
"I'm not sure why."
Kat nodded as the shuttle fell through Cadiz's atmosphere, heading towards the giant spaceport 30 kilometers from Gibraltar. The locals might not have access to many heavy weapons, but the reports suggested that they had obtained some anti-aircraft missiles they had fired at a handful of vehicles, including shuttles. Shooting down a helicopter would be annoying, but hardly fatal. Shooting down a shuttle carrying a starship commander would be a political nightmare. Even Admiral Morrison's backers would find it impossible to cover up the disaster. She leaned forward as the spaceport came into view. A giant, sprawling complex stretching out for miles. That alone was alarming, she knew. The average spaceport was nowhere near so large, even when handling military deployments. The briefing pack had noted that most of the shore leave facilities were within the wire, allowing starship crewmen to stretch their legs and relax without ever actually seeing the planet itself. Dozens of large hangars and military barracks dotted the landscape, while countless helicopters, attack craft, and shuttles sat on the ground, ready to launch at a moment's notice. It looked very far from peaceful. The shuttle came to a halt over the spaceport, then dropped down to the landing pad. Kat had a brief impression of hundreds of soldiers jogging over the base, all carrying weapons slung over their shoulders. Then the shuttle hit the ground. The shock surprised her, although she knew it shouldn't have. A hovering shuttle was terrifyingly vulnerable to more weapons than the expensive anti-aircraft missiles that might have been smuggled into the district.
The shuttle will be remaining here,
Morse said, consulting the live feed from the spaceport's control tower.
Do you wish me to remain with it?
Cat considered it briefly.
She rather doubted she would be back any time soon, even if the meeting with Admiral Morrison lasted less than an hour. The journey to and from the capital city alone would take quite some time. On the other hand, Morse was a young and inexperienced officer. Allowing him to wander the spaceport on his own might turn into a disaster.
But it was his first time on the planet's surface.
You may explore the complex, Cat said, after a moment. I'll call you when I'm on my way back to the shuttle. Keep your wrist comm with you at all times. She paused. And don't drink anything even remotely alcoholic, she added. This isn't shore leave. Aye, Captain, Morse said. Cat smiled to herself, then scrambled out of the shuttle and onto the tarmac. The heat struck her at once, a wave of warm air that sent sweat crawling down her back. She looked round and saw a handful of soldiers wearing gray urban combat dress heading towards her, led by a corporal. He saluted as he approached, his eyes flickering over her and then meeting her eyes.
Professional, Cat noted mentally.
That was a relief.
Captain Falcone, the officer said. I'm Corporal Whisperer. I've been assigned to escort you to Government House.
Thank you, Corporal, Cat said.
She allowed him and his men to lead her through the complex towards the vehicle park, where they helped her into a large armored vehicle that seemed to cross between a truck and a tank. The windows were transparent battle steel, she noted, allowing her to see out. But proof against anything short of a nuclear blast. It didn't bode well for the security situation either, she decided, as the vehicle jerked into life. A handful of smaller vehicles, some of them carrying mounted machine guns, followed them as they headed towards the gates. That definitely didn't bode well for local security. Corporal Whisper seemed to have appointed himself her local guide and pointed out a number of landmarks as they drove through the complex. The swimming pool, the library, the giant strip of shops, bars, and brothels intended to separate spacers from their money. And the prison, where irreconcilable insurgents were held, pending their exile to nightmare. Cat made a mental note to ensure the pirates were handed over for transport, then pushed the thought aside as she saw a long line of locals being searched by military police. There was almost no privacy, she realized. The locals had to endure countless humiliations just to enter the complex.
They used to smuggle in bombs, Corporal Whisper explained when she asked about the searches. Eventually, we insisted that anyone who refused to actually live within the complex had to be searched thoroughly whenever they went in or out of the gates. We found quite a few nasty surprises over the years.
Cat shuddered. She'd never liked being searched during security exercises, and the locals had to endure it almost every day. It was just another humiliation piled on top of losing control of their homeworld to outsiders. No matter the justification, she couldn't help thinking the Commonwealth would come to regret annexing Cadiz. But what other choice had there been? They passed through the gates and out into the countryside. The road was surprisingly wide, she noted, wide enough to make it difficult for someone to plant IEDs along the roadside without making them instantly noticeable. Defoliants had been used to clear the bushes away from the road, ensuring that it was hard to set up ambushes too. There would be no new growth for years, Cat knew. Just something else for the locals to hold against the occupation force. And the stripped roadway wouldn't stop a sniper from taking a shot at the convoy as it raced towards the city. Still, Cadiz was beautiful, she thought with a trace of wistfulness. She had never been able to climb mountains or even hike before joining the Navy, even when she wasn't surrounded by bodyguards and interfering tutors. Davidson had taken her mountain climbing once or twice, before their relationship had come to an end. The mountains she could see in the distance looked challenging, just the type of experience he loved. But she doubted they were safe for anyone, unless they were surrounded by armed Marines. She sucked in her breath as they entered Gibraltar, after being waved through the gates by armed soldiers. Inside, hundreds of cars and motorbikes, some so primitive they were actually fueled by gas rather than power cells, buzzed round, while the locals who